Well, I wanted to talk today about product management. I mean, what happens inside of a vendor? What is the process for a product arriving into the marketplace? I mean, a lot of people out there think that all of a sudden a new switch or a new router or a new software feature is delivered by the Pelican and it just rocks up on your doorstep with a little bow around the outside, smelling all lovely and covered in baby talc, and isn't that magic? But the reality is that it's much more like a sausage. People have been feeding babies into grinders and turning them into sausages, and that's really how it works. So I'm joined today by Omar Sultan. How are you, Omar?
Doing Greg, how about you? I'm doing great, Greg. How about yourself? So the whole visualization of baby sausages kind of threw me for a second.
I think we may have found a theme. Thanks for joining me today. Of course, now you work for Cisco. You're in the organization there that makes up products and
Thank you.
shoves them out the door. You've been doing that for quite some time.
Actually, I've been in product marketing. I'm just fresh, relatively new into the actual product management role. Just kind of focusing on SDN stuff.
Cool. SDN product management. Now
Yeah.
there's unicorns dancing on a
Unicorn
pin.
sausage.
Unicorn sausage and dancing on the head of a pin at the same time,
No
probably.
doubt.
No doubt. So, with your experience of that sort of thing, I mean, how does a product start off inside of a vendor? What's the process for initiating a product? Is it market trends? Is it customer needs? Is it angels coming down with tablets from the mountain saying, thou shalt build a product of something?
Well, it would be good to have that kind of blessing. Generally, it's a little more prosaic, right? We'll look at inputs really from one of three directions. One is intrinsic, where our engineers say, hey, this is something cool that we see that we think the market needs just based on other things they've been building. I mean, something like Lisp would be a great example of something that internally we decided, hey, this is something we think makes sense to take to market. The second one, as you might guess, is things like standards that are evolving, that are bringing specific standards to market that then need instantiation as a product. And finally, the third and often the biggest driver is customer asks around specific types of technology, specific features, extensions to things we're already doing, really it can end up being kind of an amalgamation of all three of those end up driving what a particular product looks like.
Well, standards are sometimes driven by customers too, aren't they?
Absolutely.
In the same, so customers asking vendors. So we hear the vendors saying to us a lot that, it's what the customers want. That's what we want to give them is we want to give the customers what they want. So if a customer says, I want, better ways for ISIS to converge, and then years later that turns into LFA.
And it's a little bit of a dance there, right? I mean, a lot of times customers will express, the outcome and kind of leave it to the vendors or the standards bodies to try and figure out the best way to get there. Sometimes, especially more and more these days, as customers are generally more tech and IT savvy, they're much more explicit about, we need a specific technology to behave this way. I mean, I think if you look at a lot of the customer-driven SDN initiatives, whether it's SOAP, Open Computer, or ONF, it's because customers are more savvy. They have a much more precise understanding of what they need the technology to do.
That's true, and I think that level of expertise that's rising in the customer base is something that a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's generally a net positive, right? It makes for much, from a Cisco perspective, it much makes much, for a much more productive, design session or product planning session because we have customers that can, it's not a back and forth of customers kind of vaguely trying to, describe what they're looking for, and we come back and say, okay, is this it? And they say no, and going back and forth, they can be much more explicit, which allows us to be much more focused in terms of how we bring things to market.
Yeah, and vendors have customer forums. So you have, obviously, there's things like Cisco Live where there's a lot of interaction between Cisco and its customers at those events, and all the other vendors have the same thing. And I know that Cisco also has various forums for different verticals. So there are enterprises, service providers, and some of those are very large, but they're sort of semi-private. It's invitation only, but the invitation pool's very wide. And then vendors also have, to my uncertain knowledge, direct relationships. So there's the salespeople, and then there's major accounts, and those major accounts have obviously a much stronger ask. Their voice sounds louder than everybody else's when they ask for something.
Yep. I mean, we have, you know, the general forums. We have, I mean, for Cisco, we have advisory, you know, we have more advisory boards than Leopards have spots, it seems. But, you know, they're really focused on a specific group, whether it's partners or verticals or whatever. And we'll come in and, you know, we'll create forums around industry trends, say virtualization, and get guidance from customers in terms of, okay, this is what they're really engaged in. This is where they have questions. This is what their actual implementation plans look like. And then, you know, pretty much every customer has some sort of feedback, whether it's from the biggest customers down to, you know, even the smaller customers, and, you know, have the ability to pass feedback up. And we, you know, we kind of talk about what do product managers do. You know, part of what they do is to start aggregating all that feedback and starting to look for the trends and try and figure out what becomes actionable from an engineering perspective.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I've been working with, you know, vendor salespeople for 20 years now, and sometimes I've asked for, you know, I often wonder if my inputs actually go anywhere.
They actually do. One of the, and just put my toot Cisco's horn for a second.
Yeah.
You know, anytime you see a feedback form and you fill it out, it actually does get read by a human and it gets tallied somewhere. And certainly for product feature requests and those sorts of things, those all do end up getting aggregated to a product manager. And you know, one of the critical things a product manager does is actually say no, both externally as well as internally, in terms of making sure products and features are focused and actually solve a problem instead of trying to get too much done. You know, at one time, or try and be, you know, try and keep too many people happy with a single feature and not really solve any one particular problem.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's been a problem too, because sometimes we think, you know, I've been saying in the past, there's too many knobs and buttons and magic levers, and, you know, there's always a tweak or a thing that you could always do to make one person happy, but at the price of complexity. And I think I've also talked to people in the past who says every time you add one of these features, you also have to carry that burden for the next, for eternity, I think.
You do.
Yeah.
So it seems like it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's second-order impact, right? So if you look at something like you add a feature, you now have to look at impact with things like, you know, ISSU or just high availability. Mm. You know, a lot of times features don't exist in a vacuum. They have broader systemic impact. And the complexity really does grow exponentially. Hmm. That's why you need to spend a lot of time really grooming, you know, feature requirements and feature asks, and trying to figure out what makes the most sense and what's going to be the most practical.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the company that I think does its best is Apple.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, they do a very good job of saying, okay, this is all it does. You know, it's not going to do 8,000 things. It'll do 8, but it'll do them really well in a way that's really intuitive. And I think they're very good at saying no and staying focused on a given task.
Okay, let me just throw an illustration in here, one that I understand at least, which is BFD, right? Mm-hmm. So bidirectional forwarding detection is, for the people who are listening, is a process where a sub-process inside of the routers ejects a packet that says, I'm alive, onto an interface. And the router at the other side will receive that and say, I can see it. Now, the thing about bidirectional forwarding detection is we're actually talking sub-second notification or sub-second hellos. So 10 years ago, we had OSPF or BGP. OSPF would send out a hello packet every 10 seconds. And if it wasn't received, then eventually it would know that the neighbor had gone away. Now, the problem is that generating those IP hello packets has to be done by the CPU. It's not done down in the internal guts of a router. And it actually takes a lot of CPU power to generate an IP packet and send it if you're sending it on, say, 100 interfaces at a 1 second interval or a half a second interval, because the CPUs in the gear is not usually very large. And so the feature of BFD needs to be is a great feature, because it allows the router to detect that the neighbor has failed in sub-second intervals. But to generate the packets, you need to do it on the actual silicon of the line card, especially in the big switches like the Nexuses and the Q-Fabrics and the Brocades. You actually have to generate the BFD signal in the line card where the Ethernet chip is. So now you're asking for one feature. You're asking the software people who do the routing protocols, and there's one for ISIS, one for, you know, BGP, one for OSPF, to all add BFD to their software thing, and then you're asking the silicon people to create silicon in the chip to generate the BFD, and then there's microcode in the chip that does with the BFP, and then you've got to put the linkage between the BFP in the line card with what's happening in the operating system, which then talks to the OSPF, the BGP. So just that one feature is not just, oh, why don't we add it? It actually can be quite complicated. Is that fair?
That is fair. And there's a lot of linkages. I mean, even in the software implementation, right, there's a platform-independent piece and then the platform-dependent piece. So, you know, if we take something and, you know, roll it across the entire Nexus family, you know, the group I work with will actually handle a lot of the platform independent pieces. Mm-hmm. But then the folks that own the platforms then actually own really that last hop of coding the feature so it works on a specific set of hardware.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once it's been created, it's got to be put into a test suite. Yeah. And so every time a new version is released, there's a new test that has to be done just for BFD. But BFD is so universal, you actually have to test the BFD itself on the line card, then the BFD to OSPF, the BFD to BGP, the BFD. So those types of decisions get complex really quickly.
They can. So, I mean, we start to counter that with some automation and doing things differently, right? I think this is where sometimes you see the inside baseball side of things evolve, and customers don't necessarily always have visibility to this piece, which is kind of the way it should be. But, you know, we look at things like automated, you know, test harnesses to start, you know, automating those kinds of things and catch them with that human interaction. Hmm. Internally, you know, one of the things we actually use 1PK for internally as our development tool is so we can kind of code once, deploy many. Hmm. So we can take something like BFD and code it once using 1PK, and then it greatly simplifies deployment across multiple platforms. So, yes, you know, the complexity exists, but I think, and not just Cisco, right? I think all, you know, most if not all vendors are getting much smarter about starting to collapse those deployment times and starting to reduce the burden of ongoing care and feeding, if you will.
Yeah,
to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's changing their processes as software gets smarter.
Yep.
So, you know, this idea of testing, unit testing and in-flight testing and continuous integration and stuff like that would be flowing into networking businesses, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay, so now we've got to the point where we've decided that a new feature like BFD is necessary. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at the babies that we've got piled up and looked at the sausage machine that we've got on the right-hand side. So who makes the decision to go ahead with a product? Is it consensus? Is it group? Is it does the CEO reach down from on high and put his finger on it to give it a blessing, and there's a gold glow that comes off? Or
no, so generally there's at least within Cisco, so there's a process that we go through where you know, product manager will, you know, classically we would do a, you know, you might have heard the term of PRD or product requirements document, where you essentially lay out the user, the business case or the customer use case. You'd lay out the, you know, the underlying technology pinnings, and then what the implementation entails, and then any pricing or financial or business impact, and run that through basically there used to be two phases, a concept commit and an execute commit. Concept commit would be, okay, we'll kind of like the, it's like the initial business plan saying, okay, that makes sense, go dig into it a little bit more and flesh it out. Then the concept commit would be a much more fleshed out plan where you finally take it back across, you know, essentially panel and say, okay, this is cool. We're going to commit resources and people and time to make this into reality. Within Cisco, we're shifting from a traditional waterfall methodology to a agile methodology. So kind of breaking down the formal PRD a little bit into more bite-sized things. But I think most, you know, every company does some similar sort of thing where they kind of flesh out the initial concept and then have some sort of yay and nay process and then move it to some sort of execute queue and start assigning budget and resources to it.
Okay. So I think, and every company is going to be different, right? And it's also going to be up to the product manager to have a good story there. So he's going to have to make a good pitch to get other people engaged. Different companies do different things. So I know, for example, at Cisco, there are distinguished engineers who are sort of seen as leaders. And if they're willing to, if you can get those types of people to bless it, it sort of gathers more momentum and things like that.
Yep. Yep. You have that. And it's a highly competitive situation, right? There's only, I mean, from a couple of different perspectives, A, the company's only got so many resources in terms of software engineers and those sorts of things that, you can throw at projects. So it's competitive from that perspective. But there's also kind of the thing you pointed to with BFD. There's only so much you can have the box doing. So, I mean, we don't have infinite CPU cycles. So do we really want to burn, of all the resources that we have within a given switch, do we want to roll up a feature and really commit these kinds of, you know, limited box resources to turning something up? So as much as anything else, it kind of evaluated on a number of different levels.
Mm. Yeah, there's not an infinite amount of money to support new features coming into the product.
No, and there's not an infinite amount of resources on the box to support products. So,
damn it.
Yeah.
I want it all, and I want it now.
Yeah. No, I want it for free.
Yeah, even more. So, yes.
Yeah.
So once the product, so let's say that there's a feature that's now been socialized, and I've seen this happen in many vendors, and quite often it goes into the dark side of the software development cycle and the product development. You know, the actual, somebody's got to grind out the code and go through the process. And I don't think that's very interesting because that's very vendor specific to people. And if people listening are interested, then let me know and I'll try and put together a show with somebody who can talk to you about how the actual sausage grinder works.
Yep.
But so we've got this product. We've got this product or product feature, and I imagine building a new product would actually be a much bigger thing because the funding that goes into that is enormous. Like building a whole new switch family or a whole new chipset to build, you know, next generation of chipset is a much difficult, much more different process.
Yeah, I mean, there's much more, you know, certainly there's a much more rigorous financial analysis done on something like that versus, you know, BFD2.
Yeah, that's right. Because building a chip, like the chip that if you're saying I want to make a change to the silicon, or I need to build a next generation of chip for some, you know, for some reason, because the old chipset's now no longer delivering you the features or performance. Like, you know, 40 gig means you now have to build a new Earl type chipset to actually say go at 40 gigabit. So then the question becomes, what does that chipset look like? What features do we want into it? You know, all those types of things. So very different discussions, as you say. Putting BFD in would be fairly low risk once the need was clearly established. There'd be a lot of resistance to adding it to people's timelines, but overall, not a lot of work. Building a brand new chipset, because it's more, you know, that's harder. There's a lot more money and a lot more time there. What's it, 3 years for a new chip to come through the pipe?
Yeah, I mean, probably 18 months on the inside to 3 years of, you know, straight, you know, essentially it's all sunk cost at that point, so...
Mm.
You know, it's not just that, but it's also timing the market, right? So you want to make sure you're building something that is still relevant to the market 3 years down the road, and it'll take still a number of years to recoup the investment. So the things you commit to silicon are the things you believe will have some staying power.
Well, there's a great point. Crystal balls. You must have them lined up on the walls there, surely.
That's a great thing. Everyone's got at least a couple. Doesn't really help.
Yeah. So, for example, 10 gig, right? We all thought that in the mid-2000s that 10 gig was going to be huge, and it kind of didn't. And if you invested a lot of money in building 10 gig capabilities, then you would not be happy to find that there wasn't a lot of demand for those products when they came.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, something like 10 gig, you know it's going to get there eventually. I mean, with that, you're not guessing on whether 10 gig is going to take off or not. You're really guessing on the timing of that, and this is where, you know, it can get tricky. Probably one of the things I always look back at is one of my favorite quotes from Bill Gates. Probably my only favorite quote from Bill Gates is, you know, IT tends to overestimate what happens in 2 years and underestimate what happens in 10.
Yes.
And 10 gigs like that, right? You know, for like 3 or 4 years we had this as the year of 10 gig. Then eventually it was the year of 10 gig. So for something like that, it's easier to invest in something like that because you know it's going to get there. We know eventually we're going to go to 10 gig. We know eventually, you know, 40 gig, 100 gig was a little more interesting conversation because it was, okay, we're going to go from 10 to 100 or are we going to go from 10 to 40? So, you know, that made for a little more interesting conversation. I think the trickier ones are where you're not necessarily sure the technology is going to take off. Like, do you commit to a certain type of packet format as gaining traction or not, or certain types of tunneling? You see a lot of folks, you know, you see a lot of the merchant silicon right now. Actually, tunneling is a great example right now. There's so many freaking different tunneling protocols. And if you want to try, and, you know, apparently we launched another one on Valentine's Day. But, you know, at the end of the day, you'd like to be able to have that stuff handled in hardware for performance purposes. But if you're trying to burn silicon, what do you commit to? Do you, or do you not commit to anything? Those are the ones that are, you know, make people sweat a little bit more because you're not really clear which direction the technology is going to go. So you could be 3 years down the road and have a chip that no one really cares to use.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, tunneling is a great one, right? Because and just for the people who are listening, so for example, if you're matching, say, the VXLAN header, which we all know about, you want to allocate inside of a silicon chip, you want to use the minimum amount of transistors and architecture and silicon to just match exactly what's in the VXLAN header to do what you need. But if you start talking about matching, say, against NVGRE or NV03 or whatever the latest one is this week, and there's a lot, right, or GRE or IP and IP, all of those, all of those have a different packet format. And so you might say, well, why don't you just match them all? Well, to do that, you actually have to read the entire header, and you start after having programmable logic in the interface chip to match those things. So if you're going to say, I'm just going to match everything, now you're not talking about a very small number of transistors inside of the silicon. You're talking about exponentially more. So let's say arbitrarily it takes 1,000 things to match a VXLAN header. If you're going to match an infinitely variable set, it might take over 1 million chips, you know, 1 million of things to match a variable header pattern. It's not as simple as, you know, I was talking to somebody who designs chipsets, and we have a show coming up in the future where we're actually talking to a bunch of people about hardware. I'm trying to drill more into what actually happens inside of a switch and how the silicon, what is that process in there? And so I've got some shows coming up around that. But it's not easy to just say, oh, let it be everything. It's not like a Python script where you can just keep adding another subroutine or, you know, bring in another library or, you know, do another thing and it'll run. Inside of a switch, remember, the frame size, the gap between two 10 gigabit packets is 6 nanoseconds. So you have to be able, there's certain things that have to happen in that 6 nanoseconds to refresh that chip's internal architecture. So 6 nanoseconds, just for those who haven't noticed, is not a lot of time. True?
It's true.
Yeah.
It's enough time to spin in probably a new tunneling protocol, but other than that, you can't get a lot more done.
No, that's right. You know, but inside of the engine of the chip, there's a whole bunch of things that have to happen. It's not obvious what's going on there. And you really, those people who make chips, mate, they're rocket scientists, as the old saying goes.
They are, and they're gutsy, right? Because they're committing to something long term. Although they're getting smarter. I mean, Intel's got, I think it's called flex pipes, where they have a certain amount of programmability within the microarchitecture. Mm. So they have the ability to respond to some degree, you know, reprogram the chip on the behavior of the microarchitecture on the fly. And, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, another example where software is eating the world, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, look at what modern network processors look like. They're actually starting to look more like CPUs and, you know, where in the old days we had everything was custom. We're actually seeing these general purpose network processors, or, you know, the fabric chips are obviously sort of stabilizing around some sort of standard architectures. And even the gigabit interface chips, you know, 10 gig interface, you know, that idea of having a SerDes separate from the interface processor is, there's sort of standard models coming around to sort of handle that. But they all rely on software inside of the silicon to allow it to change to some extent. You know, it comes back to this, as I understand it, the financial decision. If you make a chip and something changes, well, if you could just rewrite the software inside it, you get a lot of flexibility. You're offsetting the risk of that being obsolete by the time it comes to market.
You do. I mean, the simpler you make it, the greater the longevity. But the simpler you make it, you also run the risk of, you know, not having the more sophisticated you make it, you know, the greater performance gains or processing gains you have. Hmm. But then you run the risk of having it overly focused and limiting its useful life cycle.
Yeah.
So there's a balancing point. I do not, you know, those are folks you don't want to play poker with. The guys at the,
especially when you're talking like, you know, what is it, 1,000 people and 3 years to build a chip.
And million, you know, it's like tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to fab chips at scale. And you know, the best part is you don't really know it's going to do what you think it's going to do until you start running some prototypes and hope it works.
That's a particularly complex piece of thing. It is a hard business to be in.
Yeah, it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. So we talked about how features and functions are being added, and there's a competition going on internally between putting those together. What's And if every customer is asking for a different feature or a different capability, I mean, the bubbling up process must be enormously complicated to determine the winners.
It is. I mean, ultimately, you're trying to figure out where there's commonality with between features. I mean, let's see, how do we kind of pull things together. I'd love to say there's a spreadsheet that we pour everything into, and it's, you know, answers kick out the other side. It's probably half empirical, half chicken bones and the like. But it's really trying to pick out the trends and kind of understand what customers are asking for, and also trying to understand where we think the market is going, and looking for the intersection between those two. I think one of the biggest challenges that a product manager runs into is trying to address too broad a group of customers or asks and water down a solution. So it kind of hits a broad group, but never really addresses anyone's particular requirement. That's why I said, you know, early on, it's easy to see, you know, a good product manager, you know, knows how to say no and says, you know, we're not going to try and keep 18 different use cases happy. We're going to pick on maybe three and do those really well. The good thing is, you know, even though we have thousands and thousands of customers, really, if you pay attention to this stuff, you'll see stuff start to resolve into natural clusters of asks around, I need to improve performance, or we see virtualization spreading across our organization, how do we handle it, those sorts of things. So, you know, to some degree, it's almost like one of those big data use cases. If you get enough data points, you'll see some clusters start to naturally resolve themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what you'll often find is people are all asking for the same thing, but they might be asking it differently or from a different perspective. So somebody who's more got a VMware farm might be asking for more.
Sometimes, you know, they express the need without having a particular, you know, idea what the outcome needs to look like. We're moving to blade servers. I'm not quite sure what that means.
Yeah.
Help fix it. Okay.
But I could imagine if you listen to enough customer feedback and enough inputs from the field engineers and the salespeople, you'll probably actually start to see the same song being sung.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, and it's fairly obvious what needs to be done. You know, we need faster routing convergence. Okay. Well, how do we do that? You know, really, you know, you'd find a lot of requests saying 30 seconds for OSPF to come around. We need faster. Okay. We'll tweak the timers down to 1 second. Well, we need faster than that. Oh, okay.
Well, so that's an interesting one, right? So certainly the first part, you know, the data starts to resolve itself into clusters, at least that's my experience. The what to do is sometimes not all that obvious. Probably the most challenging ones are the ones that are driven by hype, where there's not a whole lot of operational knowledge. So pretty much everything with SDN related right now, which is my day job, is driven by hype. So we get into, I'll give you a great example. I had this conversation last week. What's the appropriate level of performance for OpenFlow controllers, for a switch, actually, to be able to pull out, you know, set up and tear down paths?
Yeah, which is, just for the people who are listening, flow setup and tear down is very intensive process. Once the flow is instantiated, data flows through the rule at wire speed, because that's all done down in silicon. But receiving the flow rule and then creating the path inside of all the chips and the silicon, you know, the CPU has to process the flow and then push it down into the silicon itself. That process is relatively intensive, and that's why it's a concern.
And for us, it's an interesting conversation right now. It's like, what level of performance should we be engineering it for? You know, and you might say, well, you know, the highest possible. Well, we can build for the highest possible, but you probably don't want to pay for a switch for the highest possible. So it's, you know, what's the most reasonable? And, you know, it's difficult because no one really has good data. Is, you know, 500 flows a second, 1,000 flows a second, 10,000 flows a second. Yeah.
And people confuse flows per second with packets per second.
Yep. There's all sorts of craziness. So, you know, from a product management perspective, that's why you can, you know, sometimes there's a chicken bone aspect to it. You know, we need to just make some good guesses of what we think customers are going to do in an access level switch. They look at, you know, average VM density, what are people doing, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And kind of draw a line in the sand and say, okay, this is what we're going to design for. And as we work through the process, we'll revise up or revise down.
And it's complicated. That particular, as you say, SDN is particularly complex because it can be almost anything to people. Yep. So if you want to use, some people are talking about using switches as firewalls. So you can instantiate flows flow rules rapidly and then remove them directly thereafter, or use them for IDS functions where they actually want to inject blocks. They want to have massive lists of drops for DDoS type functions and then just have one permit at the bottom, you know. But there are other use cases in flow-based systems where having the flow table static for most of the time because it doesn't change much, you know. So like a VMware platform, machines don't normally move around at sub-second intervals. It's usually 1 minute or two, and that you don't need to instantiate flows on the switches at high speed. It just happens occasionally.
Yep. So I mean, that's kind of what you need the filter to try and, you know, not design around corner cases or design around design around the hype and kind of, you know, bring some adult supervision to the conversation.
Okay, so let's move to the next step, which is supporting the sales cycle. Because, of course, once a vendor's made a product, we need to make a revenue from that because we have to recoup the cost that we've poured into making this feature of this product. How?
Sometimes.
Well, yeah, but even so, even if you make a feature like BFD, which is not sold for a profit, right? Yep. It's added to make your product more attractive to the customer. You've still got to share that, tell people about it so that they use it, so that they can perceive that you're doing something for them, surely.
So, talk about taking things to market, really the two pieces, right? The one you just touched on was pricing. And its pricing can be pretty straightforward. If it's something like we talked about BFD version 2, we have established model pricing models where you just feed a feature in and the pricing is kicked out and maybe no cost, or it could be a cost associated with it. But sometimes, you price things because you're looking to create market share. You're trying to look to establish a footprint or those sorts of things. And that's part of the initial decision around pricing is, what's our objective? Is, are we looking for profitability? Are we looking for mind share? Are we looking to shift market perceptions? Then we need to be able to, really hand off to the product marketing folks and help them build a story around, the use case. This is the issue you have. This is the problem you solve. This is why this is the solution you want and why it's better than the other things out there. This is why if you have, do a crisp job up front in terms of building why you need this, it really makes the field enablement piece a lot easier, because you have a nice crisp story about, okay, this is a feature, this is why you care, this is what it does for you. If you have this many tentacled monster on the front end, it really complicates messaging, and you end up with mushy kind of messaging on the back end. And certainly my employer has been guilty of that on more than one occasion. I think I've probably been guilty of it on more than one occasion.
There's two sides to that, of course, right? There's, if you're trying to sell a feature like BFD, that's reasonably straightforward. We can now enhance the routing process to converge in sub-second intervals. Boom. Yep. Really, really good, right?
Yep.
We've just created the Earl 10,000, Sorry, there's a bit of a joke there. For those of you who don't know, the Earl sort of came out in, 1998 or something, the first Earl?
And iterated the heck out of it.
And it's gone 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't know what the latest number is, so I'll just say 10,000 is a bit of a joke.
Yeah, it's probably safe.
The new Earl 10,000 has got, chrome tailpipes and all sorts of great things. And, is a triumph of silicon design and product manufacturing at 24 nanometers, and all this sort of stuff. But messaging that to people is a hell of a lot harder.
To some degree, hardware is always easy because it's tangible, right? I think the bigger challenge you have is the Lotus Notes problem, if you will, where intuitively it's kind of cool and useful, but you can't create a crisp use case or we can't define the killer app for it. It ends up being the much more challenging thing for some of these technologies. Technology that's near and dear to my heart, we referenced earlier, is Lisp. It was, intuitively, it's a great technology, there's lots of cool things you can do with it, but it's really hard to point to a thing that it fixes other than maybe, IPv4, v6 transition. And so it's one of those things that's going to, we still firmly believe it's going to be, successful going forward, but it's on a really long fuse. So, some crispness of purpose on the front end gets, translated to, easier and crisper messaging on the back end by the time you get back to field enablement around things.
Yeah.
And, it's part of that then is also being able to, explain competitive, positioning and why is this better or worse than anything else that's on the market, helping customers, look at, when you look at cost, things also help customers understand lifecycle costs and, something on the front end might cost you some money on the front end, but help lower overall TCO for the customer. So that stuff needs to get modeled and validated and, kind of give the field a complete package in which to be able to position a feature or a new product.
One of the things that Cisco does very, very well here is documentation. And when they bring out new features like BFD, you often see this amazing document which explains why BFD happens. And my Cisco account managers often hate me because I'm always asking them for it, because there's usually a secret magic document internally to the organization that talks about the feature in detail. And if you can get your hands on that, that's the thing to get. So the best document I ever read on BFD was about 4 years ago, when the internal white paper, technical white paper, which explained it all. It didn't have anything in it that's not secret or special or whatever, but it just explained the intention and the idea and the future. You could see the future coming out of it. And that documentation actually is one of the things that Cisco does way better than everybody else. I mean, but that information is important for me as a customer to be able to see what a feature does. And a lot of people fail to understand that, I think.
Why, thank you. We certainly try. And we do have some very good dedicated documentation teams. And I think that's one of the reasons is we do have dedicated folks that do nothing but documentation. We don't ask the engineers to then turn around and document what they're doing or make it someone else's, second or third job. But hand it off to someone whose day job is to do tech docs.
And, search for it. I mean, even ask for it, because if you're in a lucky enough position to be able to get to a vendor salesperson, if you've got a sales contact, there's a lot of documentation that they can give you, which is not restricted. It's not secret. They're not breaching anything. It's just not necessarily the right thing to publish widely to the audience, because people could misinterpret it.
Yeah.
It comes back to this, how do you tell a story? And there might be things in the document that requires an advanced, a certain mindset to understand, or someone who's focused on it the right way to see the goods and the bads of a good product. And if you read it one way, you might just only see bad things in there and see the limitations. But if you read it another way, you say, this is the right way to go about, this is as good a solution as we're going to get. And you don't necessarily want to present your products you don't want to allow people to interpret the bad in a product, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, bug your recipes, and I mean, they can to be able to shake most of that stuff loose to you. Greg's got it a spot on. And the reality is they're internal docs, so they're not written with an eye towards external consumption, not because it's sometimes.
Everybody wants to read the documentation in the light of their own experiences and their own position.
Yep.
And it can be sometimes it takes a while to learn that. And certainly I'm guilty of this, right, that there's a bigger picture. And that's part of the reason why we're talking about this product management process, to understand, to think about, have empathy for the process of creating a product is actually not all that straightforward. It's actually, companies are putting big money into developing features and products. If it's as complicated as a chip, it's hundreds of millions. If it's sometimes it's just a small software tweak, new timers in OSPF? Yeah, that's not hard to do, and put a warning in the documentation. You too can make a mistake by doing these timers too small. Yeah. Stupidity cannot be prevented. So that was the process for having the show. Now, so Omar, we've covered everything I had on a list that I thought we're talking about. Have we missed anything?
I don't think so. I mean, no. I think just from, what makes my life helpful, if you're passing things back to whatever vendors, you're dealing with Cisco or whomever, I really think, the more context you can provide for an ask, the more helpful it is in terms of helping engineering teams understand what you're trying to get to, which then increases the odds of, your things starting to get codified into product plans.
So when you say context, what do you mean by that?
So it's not like, I need faster OSPF timers, but really try and explain what you're trying to accomplish. Why do you need faster OSPF timers? What's the problem you're looking to solve? And really help understand what the outcome is for, at the end of the day, technology still, in this example I always use is, customers don't want shovels, they want holes.
It's genius.
So you give us the same thing. You know, tell us not necessarily what, not just the tool, but what the outcome is you're looking for. Because part of what's helpful with that is, A, what you talked about, you know, trying to assess broader trends across the customer base. But B, you know, we also have, you know, fairly smart people inside the company too. So if you're saying I'm trying to get to X, you know, it can get their brains working in terms of other things that can help you get to X.
I want my hole to have straight sides.
Yeah.
And I want, you know, it just to magically appear, but I want to use a hand shovel. I don't want to use a digger, is what you're saying. So you want to sort of...
I mean, so I need my hole to have a flat bottom. I mean, if you plant trees or stuff, you know, I want my hole to have a flat bottom. So, you know, you're not going to use a shovel versus a spade type of thing.
Why do you want OSPF timers? What's the problem you're trying to solve? What is the use case that ultimately leads you to say, I need better timers? Because sometimes if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And, you know, if you say, I need faster OSPF timers to get faster convergence in case of an outage, well, maybe what you're actually looking for is BFD, which does faster neighbor detection. Failure of the neighbor detection, you should be implementing BFD, not having faster OSPF timers.
Yes, exactly.
I always like it when I can turn it into something useful.
Useful is good.
Yeah, and practical. I can apply that sort of thing. Omar, thanks so much for joining us on the show today. It's been great to talk to you, and thanks for spending the time with us.
Hey, always a pleasure.
Where can people find you on the internet if they want to follow you?
On Twitter at Omar Sultan is probably the easiest way to find me right now.
Thanks a lot. We'll speak again soon. If you have any ideas about what you'd like me to cover in these sorts of chats, I think it's important, as I said, to see what sort of how the unicorns are fed into the sausage machine before they turn out into what you get as a customer sausage. And hopefully what I've tried to do in this show is show how complicated it can be to turn a product into something that you actually see. And there's something I've been guilty of, which is, you know, you can be quick to criticize vendors for not giving you what you need. But it's also, you know, the vendors also have to look into crystal balls. They have to balance how much money is available. They have to mix down what is the actual practical, what's achievable, what's possible. And it's not always as easy as it looks. As always, you're listening to Packet Pushers. We will be back again in a week or so. Don't forget to hit the website for some show notes and to follow us on Twitter. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.